Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Wednesday, May 29th. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. So, whose Kaka'ako is it, anyway?
A painter's path to a parallel universe.
The Yujiro County forecast? Economic fog may be lifting.
Filipino martial arts? Oh, yes, and real sharp.
Plus, Al Jazeera's worldview, a backyard mansion, and a new media player in today's reality check.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Great may be good, but reasonable growth may be better, especially if you remember 2009, which you do and probably don't want to dwell on any more than we do. But considering how Hawaii's economy has climbed into the sunshine since those dark days, it's good to have a little bit of perspective. Before the holiday weekend, the Economic Research Organization delivered its county forecast. And while there's mostly pretty good news in the sectors across the board still, the state may well be asking, what are we going to do about Kauai? Yujiro Executive Director Carl Bonham is back with a story behind the numbers. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Didn't mean to give you a short shrift with coming into a holiday weekend, but there's only one of you, you know.
Well, there's actually several of us, but most of them don't want to get up early and come in on the radio.
Like I said, there's only one of you.
Right.
But looking at this forecast, in some ways, is it fair to characterize this as reasonable growth?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about moderate growth rates, some acceleration. We're not talking about growth rates that are sort of put us at risk of being in a bubble or something of that nature. We're not talking about growth rates like 2005, 2006.
So wouldn't this in some ways be the preferable way of being?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't say we're in the Goldilocks economy yet. I mean, we still have too many people unemployed. We aren't sort of at the level of jobs that would get us back to where people who want jobs, everybody who wants jobs can kind of find one easily. But we're getting there. We're getting to a point where we could say that this is really about as good as it gets.
The unemployment rate, though, is a little bit deceptive because we know people have dropped out and they're just simply not part of the accounting process of it anymore.
That's right. And that's actually, that gets to the point that there aren't enough jobs out there where people are rushing back into the labor force, right? So normally what you would expect to see as a recovery begins and strengthens is you tend to see the labor force grow, and oftentimes you'll actually see the unemployment rate go up as you enter a recovery phase because people realize there are jobs out there and more people are coming in than new jobs are available. That's not happening here, and that's actually different than what's happening in the rest of the country. The labor force at the national level has been growing, and the reason the unemployment rate's been falling is because of employment growth. In Hawaii, that hasn't been the case that much. And you're getting very different answers when you look at the two different surveys. So it's kind of a mixed bag there on the labor market data.
And it's also causing a great deal of confusion because for people who are looking at, what do I do now? Who do I believe? It's gotten, quite deceptive to look at one versus the other in some cases.
I mean, the employment data comes from a smaller survey. It's generally, and it measures different things also. It's one of the reasons that the job numbers, so there's two different surveys. There's a household survey, there's an establishment survey. One of the reasons that the establishment survey would show growth, right, so growth of 2% last year and growth the previous year as well, is because you may have people getting a second job back, right? And we know that significant number of people in Hawaii have more than one job. And if you get your second job back, it doesn't change the employment number at all, right? You're only when they call you up on the phone in the household service, say, are you employed? You say yes. You can't say yes twice because you have two different jobs. And so that's one reason we may see differences.
But what it does mean, though, is that people have more money to spend.
Absolutely.
And that money we're seeing turn up in retail, you know, the retail section. People are putting more jobs into retail. People are presumably going out and spending more. So you got to look behind some of this stuff to really see what the true effects of it are.
That's right. We saw close to 3% growth in the trade sector, retail and wholesale trade, on Oahu last year. As you mentioned earlier about Kauai, their retail trade sector has declined for the last 3 years. Very, very small numbers. One thing you have to keep in mind when you're looking at an island the size of Kauai is that the numbers, you know, the total level is very, very small. And so you can, small changes can get you fairly large growth rates. And there it's also measured with greater error. So these are survey numbers and they're not exact counts.
It also means that they're potentially going to feel the impact of it much differently than if you obviously had a much larger pool of people.
That's right, yeah.
So that brings us to the question, though, of what do we do about Kauai, given that you've got that small island with a lot of people who are still scratching their heads thinking, how do we get on the same recovery bandwagon as everyone else, or even just feel like we're being drawn along or drafted in some way? Because it seems like everyone else has been moving along, and then there's Kauai, which is not a very comfortable place.
Well, actually, from the perspective of Kauai residents, they may be very comfortable with the level of, you know, the rate of growth in their economy, and you know they have certainly chosen certain paths in terms of building permits and construction activity that is designed to not allow growth to accelerate too fast. They've had good growth in the visitor sector. There's still quite a bit of room to grow there. I'm not sure that there's a policy that you would try to put into place to, you know, specifically for one island. You know, their economy will recover just like the others. And actually, our forecast is for because the islands other than Oahu fell farther, right? They were down farther in the recession, and they haven't recovered quite as much. What we expect to see is stronger visitor growth and stronger construction activity as we go through the next several years, so that while Oahu will have completely recovered its job numbers by the end of this year, Kauai, Maui, and Big Island will be 2014 or 2015. So they're on a recovery path, and a fairly rapid one, according to our forecast. Let's cross our fingers. And so I think there's nothing in particular that you would do to, you know, deal with one island or another. The one thing that is happening is that the Tourism Authority is trying to get visitors to visit these other islands. And, you know, we think that is happening, and it's going to happen anyway as they've got added lift, as Oahu is full. Waikiki is completely full at any peak season, and even partly almost full in some of the non-peak seasons, and so visitors will naturally begin to gravitate to places where they can actually find a room to rent.
Even if we see that there's going to be a little bit of softening in tourism, still the way they're going to be deflected to other places or just naturally gravitate to them because it's perhaps a little bit more interesting or they've done Oahu already, and there will be that kind of headroom on the other islands that allows for that.
That is the story, is that when you get to a point where, you know, Oahu is operating at 85% occupancy rate, and yet you still have, you know, I think our forecast for 2013 for Kauai is in the mid-70s occupancy rate. They've been much lower than that, and Big Island as well. Maui is further along in their recovery, but there simply aren't the available accommodations on Oahu, and people will look to the outer islands.
And have a pretty good experience doing just that.
Absolutely.
Carl, thanks for coming in and
Thank
getting
you.
Up early. We appreciate the fact that you do. Carl Bonham is the executive director and co-founder of the UH Economic Research Organization and professor of economics. He's also a member of the State of Hawaii Council on Revenues and on the UH President's Advisory Council on Hawaii Innovation and Technology Advancement. The full report is on the HPR2.org website.
Best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
That's what I want.
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 Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love don't pay my bills.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, coming up, parallel painting in living color and a new reality for a bigger online reach. But first, the original John Dominus in the backyard.
Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
Cruise down Baratania Street in Honolulu and off to your right in the 300 block, you'll see a building in the Greek Revival style. A hub of political and social life for more than 160 years, Washington Place is frequently referred to as the governor's home. That hasn't always been the case, and in today's backyard quiz, we're looking into the history of the stately old building. It was built for Sea Captain John Dominus's family in 1846, but their days together ended with the captain's death on a fur trading voyage to China. His widow, Mary Dominus, began to rent rooms to support herself and her young son, John Owen Dominus. In 1862, he married the woman who would later become the kingdom's last ruling monarch, Queen Liliuokalani. To answer today's backyard quiz, can you name the exact year when what we now call Washington Place became the official residence of Hawaii's governors? Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.com if you have the answer, or join us in the parlor a bit later and we'll tell you.
Hi, good morning. I'm Gary Hooser. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Painter Susie Anderson works in oil, and for most of her career, her plein air paintings of outdoor scenes have been clearly representational. But there's another path to her art, and it's one she's bringing to light in a new exhibit. The paintings from this other parallel course could almost be exploded images of her more pictorial work, with shapes and colors valued for their own sake. It's an intriguing new direction for her, and she's on the phone to take us along. Good morning, Susie. How are you?
I'm great, Chris. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Well, I've been enjoying looking at your new work. And when did this new direction start for you?
Well, actually, it started about 25 years ago, to tell you the truth.
Okay, it's an old direction.
When I was working a different career and I was painting, I was studying with a local artist by the name of Lau Chun, who was a fantastic more of an abstractionist, definitely an impressionist, and he impressed me with his use of color and his painting style. And then I stopped painting for about 20 years because I had a career. And when I started again, I got very involved with the outdoors, and I love plein air, which is what I've been doing for the last 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt this need to get back to the more non-objective, the more emotional side of painting.
So you started that way. I didn't realize that.
I actually did start that way. I all of my friends, when I started painting again, were surprised that I was doing the representational pieces.
Interesting. So,
but I felt even though I've been doing the plein air and doing seascapes and landscapes, I love that, and I have no intention of giving it up. But I'm finding that I can do both very successfully and with a lot of joy. And I see the parallelism between them.
Well, you know, Susie, when I was looking at some of this work, it seems, I mean, it, in a way, through abstraction, represents a lot of the same things. I mean,
that's definitely true. I'm hoping that when people see the paintings side by side, they will notice that there is a real connection between them, even though there might not be an obvious subject matter in the non-objective pieces. But if you literally, like you said, if you look very closely at the objective representational pieces, the seascapes and the landscapes, if you look closely, you will be able to isolate passages that are very abstract and very just lovely on their own.
Well, you know, Susie, what it reminded me of was when you look at an image on a screen and kind of pixelate it, in other words, you just enlarge and enlarge and enlarge until all you can see are the color and shape elements.
Exactly.
That's what your work reminded me of. Is that a fair comparison?
It is a fair comparison. But the journey that I've been on this last year, it's been an interesting one for me. None of this was intentional. But as an artist, you have to change up. You've got to experiment and try new things. And when I knew I was going to have a show at the gallery at Ward Center, I wasn't sure what I was going to be painting. But as I developed these different paintings, they were not intentionally meant to be pairs, not intentionally meant to be necessarily shown at the same time.
Hmm.
But when I finished, or almost when I was through finished, I started noticing that there was a great connection between them. And my hope is that when visitors view these paintings, they'll be able to appreciate both styles.
Well, you know, Susie, you reminded me of something, because a lot of times, you know, artists tend to just do rather than evaluate as they're going, right? And
right.
I talk to many artists, and I feel the same frequently with my own stuff, that you find out what the themes and the connecting threads are later.
Yes.
Right? Right.
Yes.
When you're doing the work, you're just doing the work. And then I sort of leave it to the critics to figure the stuff out. Do you feel that way?
I definitely feel that way. I really do. And I think there's a great connection between the arts, of course. I look at the representational pieces that I do more as opera or pop songs. If you look at the plein air, it's more like country western. Everything is wild and crazy. You get out there and you're not sure what's going to happen because of the elements. And then I go into the studio and I'm doing the abstract or the non-objective pieces, and it's like playing jazz. But there's an appreciation. I hope there will be an appreciation for all these different styles, and kind of an eye-opening experience.
With plein air work, the impression I've gotten about the work, and one of the things that it struck me about it was, I'm a photographer, so, you know, I tell you, all I need is 1 second, things to look
right.
If things just look that way for 1 second, I'm good. I've got a shot. But in plein air, especially in Hawaii, you know, the clouds are just racing across the sky, the shadows are moving. How do you capture a moment? It's got to take some time to get all that down. And while you're doing that, everything's shifting around you.
That's exactly the point. But you also, when you go out to paint plein air, you have to commit to your viewpoint, to your shadows, because you know they're going to change very, very quickly. But you have to commit to that. So you become eagle-eyed in a way, and you try to burn that impressions, those precious impressions in your brain, so that you can paint them that way on your canvas. But a lot of times, you'll have maybe 2 hours on location, and there may be a split second in those 2 hours where the whole germ, the whole thought, the whole the main part of your painting comes forth, because maybe the clouds opened up and sunlit those mountains or the seascape, And so the drama is what you're looking for when you're outdoors. And hopefully you can execute it, but it's not always, doesn't always work that way.
That skill sounds as if it would be useful in any setting, right? Thinking
Definitely.
Quickly, capturing quickly.
Oh, yes. And it helps in the studio, too. It's made me a faster painter. It's made me be able to interpret my photographs, my reference materials with a lot more understanding because I've been outside really analyzing and looking very hard at this.
Just painting fast, is there an advantage to that in terms of having the idea coalesce quickly in front of you? Do you find that that has helped you out?
Well, yes, it definitely has, although there are some painters that will go back to a scene time and time again. I'm not one of those. I really love the challenge of trying to establish a painting very early and get it done, but very few paintings are finished outdoors, and that's where the studio comes in. But I also wanted to tell you that the show that I'm having at the gallery at Ward Center, I'm also sharing the bill with a very talented ceramic artist by the name of Ryan Roberts, who teaches ceramics at Iolani School.
So they're a good. They make a good combination together in the gallery.
I believe so. A lot of Ryan's pieces are just really, really beautiful, and I would encourage everybody to come on down and see this show. And our gallery, which is Artist Cooperative, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year, which is pretty amazing.
It's
for
great
any business,
to hear.
Let alone an art gallery.
Yeah, it sure is, Susie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Chris.
You bet. Susie Anderson's new show, Double Vision, Parallel Paths, opens this weekend at the gallery at Ward Center, and you can learn more about her work at hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, a locally owned company serving Maui, Kauai, the Big Island, and Oahu. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
John McCain makes a secret trip to Syria. The president tours the Jersey Shore. And as scandals mount at the White House, comparisons to previous administrations, Nixon, Carter, Bush, are picking up steam. I'm John Donvan. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins host Neil Conan for another round of Political Junkie. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
HBR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Courtney Midla and Travis Idol of Honolulu, Brian Aoki of Mililani, and Jeff Herring of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:28. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. There's going to be a new player in Hawaii's media scene. The Huffington Post is partnering with Honolulu Civil Beat in a new online news website. Civilbeat.com editor Patty Epler is here to talk about all the details in today's reality check. And today's reality check is you.
It is, Beth Ann. Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Yes, we're very super excited about it.
This is going to be something similar to what Huffington Post has done in other places in France and in Japan. Japan was not that long ago, what, earlier this month? Or it seems like it was not that long that I read about that.
That's right. That was, I think, in May. This is actually the first time that Huffington Post has partnered with an existing news organization in the U.S., so it's unique in that regards. And as you pointed out, they have partnered with other existing news operations in Japan, France, Italy, Spain, you know, all over the world. But this will be a first for the U.S., and we're just really looking forward to being able to do it.
Now, Civil Beat's going to stay Civil Beat and do what it does. What will be the main differences that you see happening with Huffington Post entering into the picture?
Yes, that's definitely something to point out. Civil Beat will remain Civil Beat and become hopefully even stronger through this partnership. So Huffington Post, it's called HuffPost Hawaii, will be a separate site, and it will be absolutely in the vein of Huffington Post. So it'll have lifestyle, culture, entertainment, breaking news, all the things that a very robust, vibrant news website will have. And also, it will be a good platform for people in the community to get their voices heard and to join the conversation through the local blogging platform that they offer. So we're hoping that a lot of people will take advantage of that.
To say nothing of what Hawaii businesses can do, because the HuffPost, unlike Civil Beat, is an advertising-based model.
That's true. This is actually introducing a new major venue for Hawaii advertisers into the picture. And we hope to partner with the site in Japan, for instance, to do some kind of synergistic things, you know, with the Japan Hawaii market and that kind of opportunity. So, yeah, so there will be a really good opportunity for local businesses here.
So you're bringing Hawaii to the world and the world to Hawaii, and still maintaining the investigative journalism part of what's happening with Civil Beat. Do I say congratulations on your empire?
You could say that. That would be great. Although, you know, this is really just continuing Civil Beat's original mission, which was to find ways to bring a good, robust news report to folks in Hawaii. And this is another way to sort of expand that through national and international news that Huffington Post will bring.
Which will give us a whole lot more to talk about, at least you and me. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Patty Epler is the editor of CivilBeat.com. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a graphic kaka'ako facelift and the edgy impact of Filipino martial arts.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. Bert's on the line. And what's this about you going into outer space soon? Did I get that wrong, Bert?
No, you didn't get that wrong. I do plan to book a flight on the Hawaii Space Flight Laboratory launch.
Excellent.
Although, you know, I have to shrink myself down a little bit because they're really kind of gearing it up to these micro satellites that they're creating over there at UH.
That's going to create a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, a bit of a problem. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that UH has created this lab, and we've been sort of following it. They have been working on various kinds of satellites and some payloads and various experiments that they want to send up in orbit. But what's also interesting is that this is a multi-campus activity. So mm-hmm. They've got Honolulu Community College involved with some aspect, and they've also got Kauai Community College involved. And, of course, they're going to be launching from the Pacific Missile Range facility over there in Barking Sands.
So anytime you get a chance to launch something into orbit, it's a research opportunity, and that involves any number of other sciences, doesn't it, Bert?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure, you know, that's what we'll talk about, is finding out what exactly they're building into these payloads and what kinds of experiments they're going to be looking at. I'm also curious about, you know, you would think that a full-on NASA flight would involve a lot of coordination, and I'm curious to see how through the, you know, multi-campus arrangement, how they do that kind of coordination. So it'll be an interesting conversation, and it's not only scientific, but also just the whole procedure of, you know, working on a launch.
Okay, Bert, well, we'll look forward to that tonight at 5. Thanks for talking with us.
Sure thing, Chris.
Take a quick trip into Kaka'ako and you'll notice something different on Cook Street. Several of the buildings shed their faded industrial shades and now sport bright colors, graphics, graffiti, even murals that seem to represent a new vision for the area, a little something for everyone. Unless that something is a handful of high-rises and a district designation as the third city. Even so, the Hawaii Community Development Authority says the community will stay true to its roots. HCDA Executive Director Anthony Ching joins us now. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
It's just with the small cosmetic stuff that's happened, it has a fresher feel to it, which is just a foretaste of what you expect to happen in the area. Would it be fair to characterize it as a place attracting, you know, the fun and the young?
Well, most certainly. I mean, recent events, we have a concert venue that's very active, and it's a place for people to get out and about and without, I guess, the restrictions at the other locations. We have Eat the Streets, which is, and the art scene, which is an opportunity for entrepreneurs to do pop-up types of activities. And I think that's a true indication of the vitality, a growing vitality of the area, that you have that kind of pop-up interest. They're testing it and seeing that, is this something that can be sustained?
But it's more than that, too, because people are looking to live there. And obviously we've had a movement that's been afoot on the mainland for a long time of live, work, play in the same area and be able to jettison your car, walk around, bike, all those good things that that Complete Streets is trying to accomplish in some ways. But you're also talking about having to build more densely populated areas to accommodate those people.
Yes, certainly. It's been the mandate for the agency to have to realize the density that's logical there. Because if real estate location, 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 then we certainly have the location. You said live, work, play. So we can play there with the parks and proximity to other facilities. We can certainly work in the region because it's but a 10, 12-minute walk in some cases or a quick bus ride. There's many ways to utilize that convenience. So people are realizing that. There's a pent-up demand, and I believe that you'll see the proof in that developers and the state itself will be looking to establish new construction, which will allow more people to live here.
Which means you're talking high rises, which have some people very skittish. But the question would remain, what else would you necessarily do with that if you didn't have the high rise? If it would just have to stay pretty much the way things are now. You might have some of the businesses, but not necessarily the ability to live there.
You certainly need that critical mass of people. And, you know, the development that we envision, our TOD plan, it envisions different types of building typology. And what that says is you don't just have to build towers in order to accommodate the people living there, that you might have different housing types, very efficient, double-loaded mid-rise towers, townhouses. I think you'll see a resurgent of that particular building type because it's something that people will also want, variety in housing options.
The townhouse part and the low-rise, though, means that you're going to top off and only be able to have a certain amount of people who can be in there, whereas if you build a tower, you can put a lot more people into that area, especially if you're looking at trying to grow the area, as it's been growing in the last couple of years. But if you're looking to get it to up to 30,000 or so, which have been the projections, don't you have to have towers?
Yes, towers are certainly very efficient. We have examples where our Plan 690 Pokokaina, the administration's initiative there, is on its way to delivering 1,000 units there. If you were to construct 1,000 units in a typical suburban form, you would be taking up that same type of development, perhaps 300 acres, and the attendant new infrastructure that you'd have to put into place. So certainly in Kaka'ako, high-rise towers make sense for the footprint and to take advantage of the existing infrastructure that has been developed in anticipation of this very growth.
So what do you say to the people who are really concerned that somehow this is going to so change the, you know, the site plan, it's going to so change the way they regard Kaka'ako and outplace a lot of the smaller businesses and the character that has come to define the area?
You know, change is a little difficult. We have a light industrial setting, and you have pockets of residential developments there. I think what you'll see, though, is that there will be a variety. There'll be a vibrancy. We have an allowance already in our city that we can build up to 400-foot heights. And so I believe that you'll see, again, a variety. These towers are necessarily designed to be taller and more slender with the different types that you will have of buildings. I think you'll have, again, variety in terms of the skyline. So it's not like we're trying to create a wall. In any case, I think you'll find that in examining many of the current development proposals, that you'll see that the developers are very sensitive to view perspectives and look to turn their buildings skinny side on Mauka Makai. So there's many things that's underway that I think will still realize the density, but I think you'll see that it can unfold in a way that actually benefits all of us in terms of street life, in terms of the skyline and the design that's produced.
Without turning us into another Manhattan, but looking at the kind of infrastructure that you have in Kaka'ako versus if you're all the way up the line, or depending upon which way you look at it, in East Honolulu, you have a little bit better situation. So are you not as concerned with being able to meet the needs of all of those new buildings and with all of the claims on that infrastructure?
Kaka'ako has been long envisioned to be the location for new residential development. So the agency's mandate has been to prepare the area by developing infrastructure. So the pipes in the ground existing, we have some confidence because we put them there, that they are sufficient to accommodate the anticipated growth. There's still a bit more to be done, and there's coordination as the city does improvements to the Sand Island Wastewater Treatment Center, as well as the force mains that service all of East Honolulu and run through Kaka'ako.
But the bottom line for you, and perhaps for all of us especially, is that we're going to have to get over the idea that there can't be development in Kaka'ako that makes it look different from what it is now. I mean, that's what I hear you saying, is that we're going to have to change our mindset.
I think life in the city, yes, will change mindset as to what the American dream is. No white picket fence in suburban sprawl, that it will be a urban lifestyle.
Some airspace.
Yes. That urban lifestyle does not mean that you sacrifice livability or just your quality of life, because you will have much the same conveniences. I think it'll be in a manner in which you can make choices and that, allow you to live, work, and play in a community environment.
Well, with the pent-up demand that we've seen happen with other buildings where they've been gone in a snap, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Kaka'ako, and we'll be watching. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anthony Ching is the Executive Director of the Hawaii Community Development Authority. The HCDA's Kaka'ako plan includes low and high rises for mixed incomes and uses, including living, work, restaurants, retail, entertainment, and green spaces. You can find the plan at hpr2.org. Thank you. Washington Place is home to Hawaii's current governor and has been the residence of our state's top executive for decades. Yet, before it was the official address of all Hawaii governors, it was a private residence. The mansion was built in 1846 by sea captain and fur trader John Dominus for his little family, his wife, and his one small son. But an expedition to China ended all that. The ship was lost, and John Dominus was never seen again. His widow did what many had to do to maintain a family home. She rented out rooms to make ends meet. Her son, John Owen Dominus, grew up there and later found a bride in Lydia Kamakaeha, later Queen Liliuokalani. She lived in the house for most of her adult life, including the 5 months of house arrest in the years following the overthrow. This morning, we asked you if you knew when the home officially became the governor's residence. Current Governor Neil Abercrombie is now the 12th to live in the mansion, as has every governor since 1922. That's your backyard quiz for today, and many thanks to Sally Hill for this one. If you've got one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
It wasn't that long ago that Asian martial arts were a specialized study in the West. We knew in a general way that Asian cultures had evolved distinctive and very creative approaches to combat, but we didn't make much distinction among the different styles. Few could have anticipated the way martial arts have found their way into worldwide recognition, acceptance, and study. Jay Ignacio's film, The Bladed Hand, The Global Impact of the Filipino Martial Arts, takes a look at a surprising phenomenon, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Chris.
You know, we were talking a few minutes ago, and I was saying that the whole notion of combat as art is an interesting one to begin with.
Yes, yes. It was never thought of as an art, probably in the West, you know. When you had the Chinese and the Japanese arts, for example, the martial arts coming into the U.S., all of a sudden it had this esoteric appeal of being a philosophical and yet a destructive art.
Yeah, it's hard to be philosophical and, knock somebody out at the same time.
Yeah.
But yet is that part of the fascination that the West has had with martial arts in general?
Probably, but the real spark that ignited the West's love for the Asian martial arts in particular would be Bruce Lee.
Sure.
Because he opened so many doors, you know, there's so many.
He was a real bridge to the West, and he also kind of synthesize a lot of different countries and cultures, arts, Jeet Kune Do.
Yes, and the philosophy of Jeet Kune Do is very much take what is useful, discard the rest, and add what is your own. That means, you know, you're free to mix and match.
The Filipino martial arts have become the standard for, among other things, law enforcement around the world.
Yes, law enforcement and military systems.
Why?
Well, for law enforcement, where you commonly see policemen carrying batons, and the Filipino martial arts are primarily a stick art, it teaches you ways to restrain.
Non-lethal ways,
yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah. You can take them down and pin them down until they're cuffed. until they're cuffed and, you know, nothing too painful, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
For military, it works because where they do have to be...
For hand-to-hand training.
Yes, and even for knife fighting because Filipino martial arts are known as a blade art. And so we train with blades and knives. And the military do use that.
Sure. So. Jay, you were telling me that we were talking about this whole relation to art and and you know, philosophical matters. But you were telling me that in the Philippines, it really wasn't about that when it was being created.
The history of the Filipino martial arts is pretty much from the 1600s, when there were the pirates of the Sulu Sea would raid the Visayan Islands, or even up to the southern part of Luzon, that's the northernmost island. They would raid these islands for slaves and sell them maybe to the other tribesmen or even the British East India Company.
So it was really the Wild West out there.
It was, it was. And so at that time, the Philippines was occupied by Spain, and the Jesuits who were assigned in these islands were also soldiers. And they taught them their brand of fencing to the native warriors.
So it became a kind of a synthesis in a way of some Western
For
ideas
whatever
as well.
Fighting methods were in existence at that time were blended with what the Spanish brought in. And that became, that was the pretty much the beginning of what we know today as the Filipino martial arts.
Well, you know, Jay, so now we fast forward to you kind of sneaking into Russia with an HD camera that isn't going to attract too much attention from the authorities. How did that come about?
I wanted to tell a story that is uniquely Filipino. At first, I was just going to write about it. But then I figured that the Filipino martial arts are the Philippines' greatest cultural export.
That's quite a statement.
Yes, I dare say that.
Yeah.
More than any of our indigenous arts, it's the Filipino martial arts that are the greatest.
In terms of the broadest base of acceptance and how prevalent it is around the world?
Yes. I would say they're even more popular than our cuisine.
Could be. Could be.
Yeah. But anyway, I needed to tell a story, and I thought video would do this justice. But I needed to be discreet because, you know, I didn't want people asking too many questions. Why are you here? Why are you carrying a big camera? What's that? People get more suspicious when they see a big
camera. Oh, believe me
camera,
or no,
but if you look like a tourist.
Yeah, sure.
So,
but these days you can shoot with what looks like a tourist camera and get a feature film out of it, can't you?
Actually, even with your cell phone.
That's almost scary, Jay. It really is.
I've seen some short films, and they're pretty good coming off of the smartphones.
Are you happy with the result? Do you feel that you've really gotten the story out there that you wanted to get out?
Yes, I am very happy. I didn't even think I could pull it off. You know, I did most of the film alone.
Really? This your first?
It's my first. I was filming everything. I was the one asking questions, and even the editing.
Well, you know, that sort of speaks to contemporary filmmaking and how it's really brought within reach of somebody who was essentially a writer, right? Was that how you describe yourself going into this?
I did so many things.
Yeah. But, I mean, becoming a documentary filmmaker doesn't sound as if it was a huge adaptation for you.
Not much.
Well,
I was a musician for most of my life. Writing songs and performing around the Philippines. And
well, proof that musicians can find useful things to do with their lives.
Yeah.
Jay, it's great to talk to you this morning.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Jay Ignacio is the director of The Bladed Hand, The Global Impact of the Filipino Martial Arts. It'll be shown tonight and tomorrow at the Honolulu Museum of Arts, Doris Duke Theater, and details are at hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
Mango Season's debut in HPR's Atherton at 7:30 on Saturday, June 1st, will feature the release of the group's first CD, Flying Home. The Kickstarter-funded album is a sampling of the sun-kissed island soul jazz born of their travels and stories. The evening celebrates Flying Home with 9 original new works and 5 cover songs sung in 5 different languages. For reservations, call 955-8821 during business hours.
We're kind of coming to grips with the fact that Hawaii, as we know it, is really changing.
Yes, it is.
And we talk about that change with a little bit of trepidation, because it's scary to make changes. And yet we know that we have to make trade-offs and that we're going to have to accommodate in some ways and hopefully do it as wisely as we can. Talking about Kaka'ako, even seeing some of the facelift that's happened now, yes, as cosmetic as it may be, is a good thing. But being able to bring more people toward cities, as we've been trying to do lately, I know you're a New York guy. What do you make of this?
Well, obviously, the urban core of New York City, where I grew up, is not going anywhere because it's stuck on an island. But, you know,
so
others,
are we.
Yeah, exactly. And a city, you know, is a densely populated area, so why not face that fact? And remaking Kaka'ako with a sort of a recognition of a new approach, a new century approach to urban planning, is probably makes an awful lot of sense, because the population isn't going to be going anywhere else, right?
Just up.
Exactly.
All right.
Nowhere to go but up.
Well, we're going to get out of here. That's what we're going to do. So we're going to say goodbye to you for the moment. But coming up tomorrow, same procedure, different cost. We're going to look at billing disparities among hospitals.
And we'll quaff the world's oldest alcoholic beverage.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, you can find it all on hpr2.org.
Talk back to your radio. Find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation and tweet us at HI Conversation.
And you're
Chris Vanderkamp.
And I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. One day I'm going to say I'm you. And we'll both
be
meet
true.
You tomorrow morning right here for more conversation.